This week on the show, piracy doesn't work, at least in New York City. Will 3D survive 2011? And Hollywood is experimenting with a crazy notion of actually making good movies. Right here on This Week in Media, number 216. Hey everyone, this is Alex, and we are back. I am back. We've been here. Everyone else has been here. I've just been gone. I've been out of the country, but I'm back, and we have most of the usual suspects coming in from LA. We've got Tim Street. Hey, Tim.
Hey, how's it going, Alex? How was the trip?
It was good. It was good. I was in Rwanda, and we're working with the Rwandan government on a media training facility there, and so I was talking there and meeting lots of cool people, and getting on television talking about what we were doing, and just having a great time seeing a little bit of Rwanda. It's an amazing country. You know, I know that most people only know what its history, but it's they're really focusing on technology, and they're running these fiber backbones, and they're kind of looking at what the United States did and then improving dramatically over what we did. So anyway, we'll be more about that when we get going. Also here, Lon Seidman. Hey, Lon.
Hello.
And where are you coming to us from today?
Well, today I'm actually in a supply closet in a warehouse. long story, but it's quiet and I can plug into the internet directly.
And where is this said warehouse?
Right now I'm in Clinton, Connecticut. Hmm. And my other business, one that helps fund all my other projects, and had a couple things that had to wrap up here, so I'm going to be in the closet for a little bit.
Your closet has actually surprisingly good acoustics.
Well, you know, it really does. It's mainly because it's very small, so it's a good thing I'm not too claustrophobic, but we also just had like the winter storm of the century up here, so it's been interesting.
Absolutely. Also coming in from, I believe, L.A., Larry Jordan. Hey, Larry.
And you are correct. It is L.A. By the way, the reason that Lon is in the closet is he's got a 7-foot snowdrift outside the door and he can't get out.
That's exactly it.
So I think the big question for the show will be, when will Lon come out of the closet? So anyway.
I could hear that one coming.
Yeah, you know, you threw me a softball and I hit it. So we have, got a lot of good stories here coming up. This is the story. Well, here's the first story. It's not on the list, guys. I'm going to throw you a curve, but we were talking about it a little bit before the show. So what is going on? Tim, what is going on with Skype? We almost, I had trouble getting the show off the ground today. I couldn't even get a hold of the Skype test call to do the testing. We've had outages last week. I know I was in South Africa, not able to call anybody because I couldn't. Everybody was grayed out. What's going on?
Well, the search term "is Skype down" is becoming very popular on Google right now. It seems that there's been all kinds of super outages going on with Skype. I have no idea what's caused the problem, but it seems to have been like a worldwide outage around December 22nd.
Now, one of the things that is rumored that's going on is somehow there's some kind of failure going on with the supernodes. Now, the supernodes, there's millions of people using it, but there's some classified number of supernodes, and the people who are supernodes don't even know they're supernodes, and they're the ones that are kind of keeping track of who's talking to who and acting as, in the background, acting as kind of connectors. And the theory is that something's going on where all these supernodes are going offline. No one's really sure exactly what it's causing it, but Larry, the question for you is, Skype has become a real piece of a lot of people's, whether it's their shows or how they communicate with people or business. Is this going, if this lasts much longer, is this going to damage Skype's usability permanently?
Well, I don't think anything is going to damage Skype's usability permanently unless it dies totally. But what this does do, and speaks to something I've been thinking about a lot over the last couple months, is we've got this immense rush to the cloud. We see them, even Microsoft is advertising the cloud in its advertisements. And the cloud is not necessarily a secure place to put stuff. And so one of the questions that I've got is, when you are using the cloud, what is it best used for? And my feeling is, as you are illustrating, Alex, you have almost mission critical stuff that's on Skype in terms of this show and the other stuff that you're doing. Yet I don't think the cloud is yet ready for mission critical. I think that it's still in the process of evolving. And for me, the issue of Skype is not Skype, but a broader issue of how reliable is the cloud.
Yeah, I know that while it is affecting me only in a minor way at the moment, I can't even imagine. I haven't been able to talk to Leo. I can't imagine what's going on over at Twit, because like all their shows are running on Skype and all those things. And I know that the first thing that I mean, literally within the first couple minutes that Skype wasn't working, I was like, I need to find another VoIP supplier. You know, like I need to back this up with three or four other solutions, because I just don't know if this one's really going to work. Lon, do you think they're going to see a mad rush? Is this a boom for the other VoIP providers?
It definitely is, especially if they can somehow buy into that Skype is down keyword and get some people to come over their way. I was thinking about this week too, because think about what would happen if suddenly the telephone network just went dead like Skype did off and on over the last couple of weeks. I mean, it's almost unconscionable that would happen. And it shows you really how much in its infancy all of these tools are. But what's staggering to me, I don't know if you look at the bottom of your Skype window, it tells you how many people are online. And when I first got on Skype, I think that number was in the low millions, if not under a million, maybe a little bit over a million. Yeah. And now it's regularly over 20 million people. I can't even imagine just the infrastructure needed to keep track of all those people there. And this could very well be like a Twitter problem, a scaling issue, that as more and more people are coming online, Skype is the easiest and most universal way to do a video chat. And especially around the holiday time when you want to see family and friends that can't make it to you or get stuck somewhere like with the snowstorm, they could very well be just dealing with issues of capacity and a system that was designed for a much smaller user base. So,
right. I mean, this is probably the biggest holiday season for Skype ever. You know, when you look at the number of people using it and how they're using it and so on and so forth, this might be it just literally reached a point where it's not built for this.
It's a lot of people to keep track of too. It's just maybe hitting its cap, as they say. So there's probably a good opportunity if somebody wants to try to do something different.
Lon makes a really good point I want to pick up on in comparing Skype to the telephone network. If we look at the telephone network, which has been growing for the last 120 years, and the redundancy that's built into it, we're comparing the redundancy and resiliency of a system that's 120 years old versus something which is, 5 or 10 years old. You just don't have the same level of redundancy, and yet it's very easy to compare the two.
Well, and we've had issues with power with to some degree telephones now and again when these systems haven't have had massive failures. But this is an issue. But this is one of the big things that came up when a lot of people were moving their phones to VoIP, and there was a lot of regulation of making sure that people understood that 911 may not, not 911, but 911, calling 911 may not work the same way with VoIP as it would with a phone. And this is a good example. I mean, if you were only using Skype to communicate with the outside world, which I don't think most people who are using Skype are only using Skype, but you'd be in a real bind, because you would, your house is on fire and Skype isn't working. So.
But remember, Alex, that on every Skype window that I see when I was logging in, there's a big note saying you can't use Skype for emergency calls.
Right. You can't use any of the VoIP for emergency calls right now. So, and I think that a lot of that's trying to protect people from depending on one of these things. So, and also it's difficult to track it. I think a lot of times emergency responders want to know where you are when you call.
Yep. And you can't do that when it's an internet-based call.
Yeah. I actually, I had a conversation with a large ticket agency, and it was really funny. There's a little bit of a sidetrack, but I'm from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, and one of the things we're known for is that Steeler fans are insane. I mean, they're just like not part of the rest of the world, and they will show up. There was a game actually in San Diego where more Steeler fans showed up in San Diego than San Diego fans, and as a result, they started making these rules where the ticket master could basically. San Diego or Green Bay or whatever could actually block certain area codes. Say that, you can't order tickets from the 412 area code or the 724 area code specifically. And, of course, I'm sitting there talking to someone who writes programming for this and going, So how does it handle Skype? How does it know where you are when you if you called in with Skype, how would you know? And he's like, oh, you wouldn't. And then, of course, I was blogging it in Pittsburgh. Like, okay, so if you want to order tickets somewhere else, you just go to, you know, just use your Skype call. Anyway, so that might be one of the issues that's going on there. All right, off to our regular stories. Money Drop. I had never actually heard of Money Drop until this happened. I think I don't watch enough TV. But this is called...
It's a new show. Brand new show.
Okay, it's brand new. Okay, I was like, where did this show come from? So it's based on a UK show, and it's called The $1 Million Money Drop. And you get $1 million, and then you have to answer a bunch of questions to hang on to it. And here's what happened is that Gabe Okoye and Brittany Maitai were contestants, and they were asked which came first, the Walkman or the Post-it notes, and he guessed Post-it notes, and they said he was wrong, and he lost $800,000. And then he later on lost the rest of it. But the point is it turns out after really a lot of internet cloud research, people started pointing out that, you know, he was actually right. The Post-its came out first. And now Fox is offering him to come back and do it again. They're not offering him any money. They're offering him to, you know, the couple can come back and try to play again. Here's the question: Is that enough? Should they have provided Tim? Should they have provided more than just another chance to win after making a huge technical error?
I think if they would have given him the money back, it would have been a huge publicity stunt. But there's probably some game show rule somewhere that they can't do that. I've worked on game shows before, and they have incredible amount of rules and regulations and standards and practices that go over everything with a fine-tooth comb to make it fair for everyone. So that's probably why they can't give them the money, but it sure would have been nice if they could have.
Larry, do you think that this damages or helps the show as far as publicity goes?
Well, there's a saying in Hollywood that any publicity is good publicity. And if you notice, the show has not yet been renewed for a second season. So there's not even a surety that there's going to be a second show for this couple to come back and play on.
Well, this just to defend the show, because a friend of mine is hosting the show, it was just a holiday stunt. So if it does well, it may come back.
Oh, absolutely. I'm not saying it wasn't coming back, but to promise them a return visit, the show itself hasn't even been promised a return visit from the network. You know, I think that from a publicity point of view, Tim is absolutely right. Fox would have been best off to give the couple their money and say, boy, we screwed up. And the thought that first came to my mind when I read this story is what would happen if the shoes were reversed? What happens if Fox gave the couple $800,000 and it was the couple's mistake, not Fox's mistake, that they won it? What would Fox do in that case? Would they come and take the money back?
You know, I bet you they wouldn't. You know, I bet you if it was the other, if it was reversed, my guess is Fox would say, oh, you got us.
they'd have the government come do it with taxes.
Right. But I mean, I think the Fox would just say, you know, that was, you know, we thought that they were, you know, I think Fox would not try to take the money back if the roles were reversed, because I don't think they could. I think that there's, as Tim was talking about with a lot of the requirements, I just think that, you know, once you walk away with the money in a game show, I think it's very hard to get that money back unless you, as a contestant, purposefully defrauded the network.
Tim, you've worked on game shows. You know, a game show has a prize budget where they budget how much money they're going to give away in prizes over the course of a season based upon the statistics of who wins and who loses. Do you think the game show prize budget would have had an impact on whether they give the folks the money or not?
No, I really think it's standards and practices. You know, one of the cool things that Monty Hall used to do was that he would figure out what the taxes were going to be on the prize, and then he would include cash on top of that, so that when they won the washer and dryer and, you know, $100 in cash, that cash would cover the taxes. That's just the kind of guy Monty Hall was. And I got to work with him on some stuff at Game Show Network, and he was a lot of fun. But when I worked on a game show called Remote Control at MTV, we just had a laundry list of things we could and couldn't do on the show as workers on the show. And then on top of that, there was a whole, like there was a person on set from Standards and Practices who would go over everything with a fine tooth comb.
Right.
And as crazy.
Now, here, Lon, I have a question for you. This is a bigger thing. So we had an expert. We had producers and we had researchers doing all this research, and they were wrong. What happened, you know, really is how this really came up is that as soon as he made the error, or as soon as he theoretically missed the case, what happened is what happens a lot of times when people are watching game shows. Suddenly, the Google hit for Post-its and Walkmans skyrocketed, and then people started pointing out that they were wrong. Is this, I think that this is a very interesting juxtaposition of the kind of the old establishment way of doing things and the cloud, you know, of people trying to figure this, of people able to figure something out faster than the experts.
Totally. And that was what really struck me about this story was just how quickly the cloud reacted and watching those search trends. I would love to be at Google when these shows are on the air to see how that gets impacted. I used to check iTunes after American Idol shows just to see if those songs that were performed were moving up on the iTunes ladder. And sure enough, most of the time they were. So there's certainly a real reaction here. I think for 3M, this is the real opportunity, is that Post-its are really such a part of many internet memes. You know, how many offices have we seen peppered with Post-it notes and everything else? I think this couple and 3M should get together and do something, because clearly there's an interest in it. We're talking about it. Great marketing opportunity, and maybe this couple won't get $800,000 back, but maybe they can at least get enough to pay for the wedding that they're planning. But
you know, I got to say, if 3M gave them $100,000 and a life supply of Post-it notes, that would be great PR.
I mean, you could do it. Exactly. It'd be great PR. It'd be great for them. Great for everybody. And 3M gets so much out of all this internet stuff now as it is. It's pretty cool. So,
yeah.
And you know, I was on a game show once. I won a copy of Encarta 97.
What game show were you on?
I was on Remember This. It was on MSNBC right when they first got on the air. And it was quite an experience. I mean, it's not, you know, it's funny is these contestants don't come out of thin air. There was a tryout on my campus, and I got picked as the alternate. They picked us up at 4 o'clock in the morning in a limo and drove us out to New York City. Actually, yeah, it was in New York City. They put us up in Times Square for the night. It was actually kind of a fun trip. I got to meet Al Roker, who was the host, and I was the weatherman on my campus television station at the time. So it was kind of a neat thing to talk shop.
We've always said my father should be on like Trivial, on whatever it is, the what's the one where they answer with a question? I can't think of it.
Jeopardy.
Because he, you know, when we played Trivial Pursuit with my dad when I was a kid, even when I was a teen, we'd play with my dad, and he had to answer every question on the card. Otherwise, he would win in one turn. So he had every turn, he had to answer every question. It wasn't what color. It was all of them, because otherwise, we just had to slow him down. He'd still win every game. We just had to kind of slow him down so it turned into a game. So anyway, game shows are crazy.
Also, Alex, did you notice that when all this stuff broke, the very first thing the producers did is, of course, say, well, we're right and they're wrong, before they even did their research?
Yeah, that's they won't do that again.
No, a knee-jerk reaction in the wrong direction.
Well, I have to admit that I'm pretty careful now when I see when people argue with us online or poke something at me. You know, I've learned not to react too quickly. You know, especially on anything that's fact driven, I kind of have to go, well, I'm going to go out and Google a little bit and do some research, because you just don't know anymore. I mean, if someone's coming up, well, and the thing is that there is this ability to gather information so quickly now when it comes to Google and Wikipedia and everything else, is that there's almost no excuse to be factually off very often. Because you can gather so much information with a couple keystrokes. I mean, you had people all over the world gathering the information about this faster than probably the research assistant who was calling people. You know,
they were using the Onion as their fact finding source.
Exactly. So the next story: New York City has a new message, a new important message in this economic downturn that we're having across the United States, and the hardship that we're dealing with. They want to make sure that people know that piracy just doesn't work. It just doesn't work. And they're and they have a whole publicly funded anti-piracy ad campaign that's going out right now. These are all over the city, evidently. And there's more than 700,000 jobs in the city that are connected directly or indirectly to media. So it's a big business. And I got to say that I hope that they're getting funding from this from Hollywood. I hope they're not just doing this on their own, because it seems like something that Hollywood, you know, should pay for. But here's the question, Tim: do these really work? I mean, do these campaigns do they really have an impact on the people who are actually doing piracy?
Oh yeah, all the pirates just laid down their computers, took the weekend off just because of this campaign. Worked like a charm.
Yeah, that's always the question is you run these. And I guess that there is this ongoing campaign. It's like a branding campaign where you're not expecting people to do things immediately, but you're trying to make sure that people get that it's just not okay. Larry, you know, a lot of times we talk about the effectiveness of or the damage that piracy has. Do you think that piracy really has the impact on the industry that is claimed by the industry pundits?
Oh, without question. And I think there's a couple of things. I wrote a blog about this yesterday. I was looking back at 2010, trying to think about what trends I saw that were moving forward. And one of the thoughts that occurred to me is that if pirates cared about the results of their actions, they wouldn't be pirates. Pirates don't care about the impact they have. They care just about themselves. And yet a pirate can't exist in a vacuum. In order for a pirate to be successful, people have to take advantage of the piracy. In other words, you can't just simply offer free DVDs unless there's somebody that wants to take the DVD from you and in taking it doesn't buy the real one. So this is a two-sided sword. In an answer to Tim is absolutely correct in his cynical reaction of course the pirates stopped doing everything because they didn't. But the alternative is to do nothing. And so the question is, what is it that allows us to break one of the links in the chain, either to shut the pirates down, which is not likely because new ones show up, or to convince people of the error of their ways? And I think that this is targeted not at the pirate, but the consumer of the piracy.
Well, but I think that one of the things about that, though, is that when you ask this question, I mean, the issue, there's a lot of areas where I've seen software as well as all kinds of other media and so on and so forth that has actually done really well either in concert with piracy or in spite of it. And so the question is that it doesn't seem to be a one-to-one relationship. I think that's the thing that gets confusing for people. But like, for instance, some of the most I work in 3D, and there was a program when I, you know, was growing up in the 1990s called Electric Image. And that's what I used a lot for my broadcast stuff and Star Wars and everything else. It had the best encryption in the world. I mean, it really, you could not pirate that software, you know, period. Now, we don't hear a lot about Electric Image anymore. I mean, it's still out there, but not a lot of people use it. One of the most pirated 3D softwares in the 3D world is 3D Studio and Maya. Well, those are probably two of the most pirated software, and they are also the most used. they're the most, you know, they're actually the most popular pieces of software out there. And there's always this question about, you know, we had this discussion when I was working at a production facility. We were talking about piracy, and someone asked everybody to raise your hand if the first version of Photoshop that you owned was legal. And none of us. And we all own one now. I mean, I own a bunch of them. But at the time, this is 10, 15 years ago, none of us raised our hand. I mean, that was when we started in the early 90s. I mean, you found it from a friend, or you bought it with a friend, or you did all these other things. In the same way, you know, you have, Apple, what they did is just change the way you bought stuff. They made it easier to buy the music than it was to download it. I mean, that's the bottom line. It used to be hard and it used to be painful, and iTunes made it easy, and then people started buying it. So they changed the way that it was sold. And finally, the issue is that a lot of times people say, well, if everybody who downloads a piece of software, they would have bought it, or if they download a movie, they would have bought it. Whereas, you know, if it's all free, people download and buy a lot of things that they're not going to use. So the question that I have for you, Lon, is that does the hyperbole, you know, the idea that every downloaded item is a lost sale, does that undermine the claims that Hollywood makes?
I actually agree wholeheartedly with what you're talking about, in the sense that it's a matter of convenience for the consumer. That if the consumer is inconvenienced in acquiring these these copyrighted works to purchase. And I'm talking about the casual pirater, the people that used to exchange cassette tapes because it was easier to do that than drive down to the record store or whatever. And I think in this day and age, where we're at a point where sometimes it's easier for people to pirate something than it is to actually consume it with a purchase. And I get very nervous with the industry using the government as excessively as they are. We talked in the last show about how websites are getting shut down by the FBI and customs enforcement over copyright issues. Again, not from a corporate directive, but because the government is doing it for them. In this case, the government is advertising and trying to promote a message that the industry, in my opinion, should be funding itself, but more so that the industry should be making it easier for people to watch content the way they want to. They give it away for free on Hulu if you have it on your computer screen, but you can't watch it on your television for free without paying $3 for it. And then your device may not always work with it because it's a different format depending on which thing you're using. And, you know, you can go down the litany of issues here. But you could look to the record industry's success with online sales and the fact that they've gotten rid of DRM have given consumers total flexibility in the ability to consume their music. And I think that's where this stuff needs to go, especially with video, because video, there's just too many formats. I have an Apple TV and a Roku box so I can watch Amazon and Apple stuff. I mean, it's kind of crazy. So I think that's where we need to direct this argument is let's get it away from focusing on so much work to prevent piracy when we could be making it easier for people to purchase this stuff.
You know, the big difference, though, is that with video, you usually watch it once. I mean, there are exceptions to that. But when you're talking 3D software and you're talking music, those are things that you use over and over and over. So video is a one time, you watch it, that's it. I don't know what the right answer is.
No, that's an interesting, it's an interesting thing because it is something that you're more likely, especially if it's not very good, you're more likely to watch it only once. So I have a tendency, my wife will tell you, it drives her crazy, that there's certain movies I can, I watch a lot. But I own them, I bought the Blu-rays and I bought the, I do all that stuff. And so, but I definitely, to me, subscription services make a lot of sense. I know that one of the things for me is that there's a lot of music that I don't necessarily know if I want to buy or not. And the reason that I own a Zune, I mean, I have an iPhone and my iPhone has a certain amount of music on it, but I have a Zune that I drive around with and I travel with most of the time. And the reason that I have that Zune is because I'm able to sample music. To me, a Zune is much more of a music lover's device than the iPhone. Because you know, the Zune Marketplace, I'm paying $15 a month. I don't really care. $15 a month and I download whatever I want and I buy a couple songs you get 10 free songs a month. And it's a much better experience for me. And I feel like, I would be happy as a consumer to pay, and essentially that's what I'm doing with Netflix. I'm paying my $8 a month or I'm paying $20 a month for no reason. But I'm going to pull it down. January 1st, I'm going down to $8 because the last time I got a DVD in the mail from Netflix was April of 2009, which I didn't realize until a couple weeks ago. And so the thing is that maybe and Larry, this is a question for you, is subscription services possibly in a lot of ways the one of the ways to really solve some of these piracy issues just by making it a one-time cost that people are paying like their cable bill?
I think Lon actually is on the right direction, and Lindsay, it does pick up on the subscription, which is convenience. If it is easier to do something one way than to do it another way, people will, like water, they tend to pick the most convenient way to get from point A to point B. And a subscription is easy because you're not looking at nickel and diming yourself up, I want a piece of music. The trick with subscription is the tracking, because the back end, the artists want to know that they're being paid for their portion of the subscription fee for that time. But I like the idea of convenience, and I think that one of the mistakes that the record companies made 10, 15 years ago was that they were not paying attention to the fact that the world was changing, and they let the world change without them being in control of it. Hopefully, the video, which is at the same precipice, is going to make a smarter decision, which is to make it more convenient to access their media, which is what Tim was saying.
I mean, I remember talking to somebody, I can't remember who it was, but they were saying that the end of the the end of the music industry happened in one. It was one day in like 1999 or whatever when they met with Napster, and basically told them, we're going to put you under. And Napster was there to talk to them about how do we turn this into a legal operation? How do we get people to make money? How do we get you to make money? And they just had no interest in that. And they said that's the day that That's the day it ended.
Totally.
when they weren't going to embrace it and move with it, and you see the difficulty. You know, obviously they have to protect their business models, but when they push back too hard on companies like Apple and Amazon and some of the other companies that are trying to find aggressive ways of getting people to buy this stuff, that oftentimes know how to do it better than they do. I think that there's a big challenge that, you know, they're just going to get.
Well, Alex, can I throw in something here? One of the things I liked about writing this blog the other day is it forced me to think about a lot of stuff that I haven't paid attention to. And one of the things I've discovered in 2010 is there's a complete disconnect now between people that fund production and people that fund distribution. And they have no respect for each other. Hmm. For instance, people like Apple don't pay for the creation of music. So the cost of creating the music is something that Apple not only doesn't fund but doesn't pay attention to. They're looking strictly at what does it cost to distribute this music. And from their point of view, the content is free because the music has already been created. But from the point of view of the person that's creating the music or the producer of the music, they've got to figure out how we make our production nut back. And to me, what's been most interesting is this complete dichotomy between the people that fund production and the people that fund distribution and how little they talk to each other.
Well, but I think that also one of the things, the challenges there is that cost has gone down a lot. I mean, it is a much different model than it was, you know, 15 years ago or 20 years ago. I remember I was talking to an artist in L.A., Peter Himmelman, who's an incredible acoustic artist and one of my favorites when I was in the music industry in the early 90s. And anyway, one of the things that he did, we were talking about this a year ago, and when they funded his album, what he did is instead of going to a studio, he built one. Like, he just bought the equipment that he needed, and then he recorded his own piece. And that gave him an enormous amount of flexibility. And this was in the 90s. I mean, it was very visionary at the time. And nowadays, I mean, you really can, with a little bit of work, you know, have your own recording studio. You know, that sounds, you know, pretty close to what you would pay a lot of money for. You know, what you don't have is necessarily the engineering expertise and the producer and so on and so forth. But that cost has changed dramatically as far as creating those things. You know, I think that is one of the things that these distribution folks have been kind of pointing at, is that it's not the same as it used to be, you know. And the other question is really who's winning, because the artists oftentimes get so buried in debt to the company, to the recording companies, that when we're talking about who's going to get money out of this, it's not, you know, the artist that you're thinking you're buying from. It's Sony or it's Warner Brothers. And so I think that, do you think, Larry, and this is a question for you, Larry, do you think that the fact that people kind of get that most of the time most of that money is going back to the industry and not to the individual artists, does that make them more likely to pirate the music?
I don't think anybody understands where the music goes, least of all the buying public. They buy the people they want to listen to. They assume the money is going back to the artist, and they have no concept of what the record company or the distributors or the agents or the lawyers, none of this stuff. It's all invisible. Mm. And so as far as they're concerned, 100% of the money is going back to the artist, which is, I think, one of the other big problems, is that the money almost never goes back to the artist.
Well, and do you think, though, that the artists... This is a question for everyone. I mean, do you think that and we've talked about this a lot on this show, are the artists better off fending for themselves, not using the labels and you know, putting the stuff out themselves rather than trying to go through that pipeline, given that the distribution has become so much easier than it was 10 years ago?
Let me just before, because I know Tim and Lon are both going to have opinions on this. It really depends. And Alex, I look at the stuff that you're doing at Pixel Core is a really good example of this. You know people and work with them on a daily basis that are incredibly great visual artists that couldn't construct an English sentence if you paid them, and couldn't market their services to their mother because they have no concept of how to talk that language. Some people are artists because they don't think in business terms. And so although the technology exists for people to market themselves, one of the things that I'm learning is people in the creative industry hate marketing and sales, or they'd have been marketers. They want to do their art, whatever that is, however that's defined. And as such, then they're at a significant disadvantage of people that maybe have lower artistic talent but greater marketing skills.
Tim, what do you think?
That would be me. I'm in the lower artistic skills and working on my marketing and sales skills. you know, I mean, that's the dream I'm chasing. You know, as a creator, I want to be able to make a video, publish it, and get paid. I really don't want to deal with the marketing and the sales aspect of it, but it's necessary. And so I've not seen anybody have a turnkey solution other than being a YouTuber and doing YouTube video type character blogs. That seems to be the only model out there in terms of video where you can just publish a video and make money. And for me, I don't really want to be a YouTube video blogger. I want to tell emotionally engaging stories that move two or more emotions and have spectacle and story. And so that doesn't yet exist on the web in terms of a money-making endeavor unless you have a deal with Netflix. So I keep chasing that dream. I keep chasing that model. I see mobile video as a place for that right now, and that's where I've set my sights. But to Larry's point, absolutely, you have all these people who are incredibly talented, have no marketing skills at all, or vice versa. And right now the revenue isn't really there for someone to partner. It's kind of like you do a 50-50 deal, and it's 50-50 of a very small amount. And so until we, have these business models develop and we're able to easily sell stuff through, I mean, you take a look at Android versus Apple in terms of making an app. Right now, it's still fairly difficult to make an app for an iPad. You can make an app for an Android fairly easily, but it can't be that robust. It can't be that big. When those tables turn and it's easy as, setting up a YouTube video, maybe we'll see some new developments happen there. But there's still a level of entry, both on the technical and the marketing, that keep a lot of artists down.
So speaking of that, and speaking of marketing and building this stuff up, one of the things that we're seeing is Hollywood. This is according to the New York Times. Hollywood moves away from the middle brow. This is executives talking about the social aspect, social networking, and how it sways attendance, and how it can make something do well or bad. But a lot of this is even with all this marketing, sometimes it seems to be a bit of a hit and miss. It's unclear, which is working and which isn't working. And a lot of it just comes down to, it seems that social marketing works obviously best when the movies are good. this seems to be the conclusion that they're having with this New York Times article that, if you have a bad movie, the social networking can kill it pretty darn quickly. If you have a good movie, there's a lot of, area there. Do we think, Larry, that, there seems to be always this rubber band between quality and quantity in Hollywood? Like, they want to do something, they get edgy and artsy and they do this stuff, and then they go back to, okay, now that we figured that formula out, we're going to do that until we run it into the ground. Do we think we're now rubber banding towards quality?
If anybody in Hollywood really knew what made a hit, they'd be rich. Nobody knows what makes a hit. They don't, and which is why we have so many sequels. I was reading in the LA Times this morning that Hollywood, the next 6 months of releases, there's all sequels from Harry Potter 7 to Iron Man 2 to Toy Story 4.5. I mean, it's all looking at sequels because if it's worked in the past, it's probably going to work in the future. And because nobody knows what makes a hit, they don't know they don't know if it's the marketing that makes a hit or the story that makes a hit or the director or the artist. Names that have been very popular, Johnny Depp and the Tom, whatever his name is that I'm blanking on from Top Gun. These guys used to draw in huge amounts of people to the theater. Now they're not pulling people in anymore. Is it the stars? Nobody knows. They're clueless. So Hollywood is always saying, well, this is the new way it's going to work. This is what we're going to do, until it doesn't. And then they all scramble around to find a different way to make a hit because nobody really knows.
Now, Tim, it does seem like we have some people who are now consistently doing great movies, and most of their movies are doing pretty well. Do we think we have a coalescing quality leaders when it comes to like directors that are go-to people and are going to have an easier time getting funding because they're just repeatedly getting out that kind of, not the big blockbusters, but the maybe big blockbusters, but ones that feel like there was a lot of care put into them?
Well, it's kind of like being at the beach and standing in the sand while the waves wash up. You know, it's constantly changing. Mm-hmm. You're going to lose your footing as tastes change. I mean, you know, when we're going through a recession, you know, people don't want to see serious, depressing films. They don't seem to do too well. This year, you know, Sony kind of attacked things with a star and a, you know, high concept. They took known stars and put them in high concept films, and that seemed to work out pretty well for Sony this year. That model may not work out next year. So it's constantly changing, and with a movie, you know, it takes about 2 years to make a movie. You're really guessing what people are going to want 2 years in advance, and it makes it really tough. The huge opportunity, I think, here is for these low-cost films that are shot on the red, that are done independent, and can get made very quickly. A lot of people don't know about the AFM, the American film market, and that's a place where films are really a commodity. It's, does your film have a star that's going to do well overseas? You know, somebody like C. Thomas Howe can still open a movie overseas, but in the U.S., you know, people don't really remember who C. Thomas Howe is.
Remind our listeners who C. Thomas Howe is.
He was in a lot of movies back in the 80s, like, was it Rumblefish? Or
right.
I can't remember which one it was, but of those books made into films, he was in a couple of them. Anyway, the AFM is really a commodity market, to where, you know, does it have explosions? Does it have nudity? Does it have a recognizable male star? It's not about art. It's not about quality. It's just, does it have the things that, does it have a good trailer that they can sell internationally? And so that type of filmmaking, I really wonder, will that suffer as social media goes forward? Because it's just a volume business.
Well, I think the other thing is, and here's a question for Lon. You know, the thing about this is that you have this social media, and sometimes it unwinds, you know, an otherwise perfectly well-designed marketing plan. I mean, you know, when you see, you know, trailers, it used to be you'd see a trailer and you go, I'm going to go see that movie. But now, immediately after the movie comes out, people will say, oh, it's not as good as the trailer, or the trailer was completely you know, it was misguided. You know, there was this, you know, the Schmucks for Dinner or whatever, I think was one of the ones that people just came back and said, the trailer doesn't look anything like the movie, you know, and I think that affected it either one way or the other. People looking for a more serious movie went to it, and people looking for a less serious movie didn't. But does that demystify, does that, the ability of the cloud to inform each other quickly, does that change the way marketing has to get done?
Of course. I think they have to be more upfront with their marketing. I remember a holiday movie, Kindergarten Cop, way back in the day with Arnold Schwarzenegger, and everybody thought this movie was going to be this great little holiday, you know, fun movie with, you know, Arnold Schwarzenegger and kindergartners interacting. And it turned out to become, at the end of the movie, more of a action movie, violent thing, gunfights in a school kind of thing going on. And a lot of kids got scared, and it got out into the media, and people started talking about it a bit more. So, you know, social media speeds up that process. The TV stations don't have to get phone calls from people. It just starts to pop up on these Facebook networks, which are often more private than Twitter. So we don't really see it kind of bubbling up until it becomes, you know, this force to be reckoned with. And I think it is a problem that the industry has to look at. But I think there's also an opportunity in looking at some of the niches on social media. Every show that I like on television gets canceled in the first season. So either I have really bad, taste, or, you know, maybe they should start trying to market something to me, because I'd certainly respond to it. So I think there's two ways they can go here. I think they can do lower budget films and shows that appeal to a certain niche audience, and they should also be very careful in how they're marketing the movies that they're putting together, because it can make or break you. The other thing is the international market. You know, the American movie industry is a major export now for this country. And, you know, one film may be a very popular in one country, and another may look at it differently. So it's an immensely challenging prospect that they have to look at in the years to come, because it is changing significantly how they market things. But it also creates some real opportunities. You know, all those viral you know, those shadow marketing campaigns where they try to get people to rope in. What was that movie with the game that they did where they'd call you on the phone and give you clues and stuff? Like, that kind of thing can also be put to good use as well and try to make a discussion around the marketing.
I think so much time, so often that seems so forced. You know, I see these and I'm just like, really? I mean, do people actually play that? You know, I think that's usually my reaction to, you know, a lot of those. Now, Larry, I have a question for you. Do you think there's oftentimes in Hollywood, and this is for Larry or Tim or both, or all of you actually, there's this comment of no man's land. You know, it used to be 2 million to 20 million. This is kind of this area where if you got that kind of funding, people were worried, you know, because over 90% of the films failed, you know, financially. Because you didn't have a big enough star and you didn't have enough budget and you didn't, you know, if you're under 2 million, you know, over 80% of them succeeded because you had direct to video. And if you had over 20 million, it meant that you had the infrastructure that you required. Now, people have talked about that number getting much, you know, expanding a lot. Do you think that that the way this is going with social networking, that causes that no man's land to expand or contract?
I don't think the social networking causes the no man's land to expand or contract. I think the economics of the industry are driving that. It is really, really hard to produce a film at a $15 million level and have a turn of profit unless you've got the money dedicated to marketing. And when you're creating the film, most of the time you may not have distribution locked up. Mm-hmm. So we're seeing that you're right. Two things we're seeing. One is in the budgets for features now, especially at the independent level, not studios, are 50% that of the budget of where they were 3 years ago. So budgets have virtually been cut in half for films just because the money is not there. And the return on investment is so questionable that people that look at it simply a spreadsheet, I spend this much, I get that much, are not happy with the numbers they see. And those numbers continue up into that mid-range. And then once you get a studio behind you that's going to commit serious marketing dollars to it, then you've got a better chance, but not a guaranteed chance of getting your money back. We look at many of the films that were produced for $50 to $70 million, and they do a $7 million opening weekend. And people that we look at things like The Tourist, which did not do the kind of numbers that they were expecting, though they had two killer stars with Angelina Jolie and Johnny Depp. It's still a crapshoot, and it's even more of a crapshoot now because money is so hard to come by.
Yeah.
Well, you know, Larry, as long as you make it in 3D, you're going to be filthy rich. That's what I'm saying, Larry. It's got to be in 3D.
Tim, I don't know what you're drinking, but I want some of it.
Yeah. Here's the question is also, does the, for any of you, does the, is the model of the, you know, the film festivals that are building towards purchase, is that still working? I mean, is it, or do you have to really go towards the internet?
The film festival model, the problem with that is that the marketing story gets out at the festival so that when the film is released theatrically, there's no story. All the news is done, nobody covers it, and the film dies in the theaters. That has happened over and over and over. And so now all the publicists are telling people when they get their film into a festival to be quiet. Don't give out your story. Don't talk about it. Don't give away the story till it gets into the theaters.
Interesting. I know.
You know, Tim is absolutely right. I had to check because I was going blank mentally. 3D has been popular this year. There's no question. And 8% of this year's box office revenue, according to the LA Times, or $850 million, came from just the difference in price between a 2D and a 3D version of a feature film. So 3D has been a big profit generator this year for Hollywood.
Now, will it continue to be, though? I mean, do we think that we're going to see – Lon, do you see yourself going to a lot of these 3D films? Do you go to a lot of the 3D films?
I rarely go to the movies. I just hate going to the movies. But I have felt compelled to leave my couch to go to a few, and I haven't yet. But the 3D is enticing, especially, you know, a film like Avatar or maybe some of the other sci-fi movies on the horizon, which would really do well by that. I heard Tron is pretty cool to watch in 3D. So I think that does. I mean, I haven't been compelled to buy that for my home, but that's something that might get me off my butt to go in and see a movie, and apparently other people as well.
And this isn't a story that we had listed, but I think it's a good discussion here. Is as we go in towards 3D, Is there a danger right now? And I think I tweeted this. I was just like, I was reading a bunch of stuff about it. But you're talking about, okay, so there's a bunch of different formats. And that's okay in the theater because they're supplying you with the glasses. But now they're packaging. Like, you have to buy the glasses with the movie. So now a Blu-ray costs $200 because you have to buy the glasses with it. Or the movie only works on certain TVs. Is this the 3D industry, you know, killing itself? By creating all these exclusive and making it too complicated for the consumer.
Totally. It's totally killing itself. And that's what's worked in the movie theater is that you show up, you pay your ticket price, you get a pair of glasses, and you're good to go. And on the home side, I'm a tech guy. I don't even know what to get. And I have no desire at this point because there isn't a standard that's kind of worked itself out. And you could end up with a television and a Blu-ray player, a significant investment that could very well be obsolete in a year or two when standards get worked out or don't get worked out at all and the whole thing collapses. So I think they've definitely got some work to do. I think where it's going to really need to go is that Apple holographic display or something where I don't have to buy anything. You know, the thing that I buy is going to work. I don't have to wear glasses and have an extra set for when the neighbors are over or something like that. I mean, there needs to be some sanity to this thing. And I think the movie theater works great for it because it is a place where people go. You can give them all a pair of glasses and the scale is such that it makes sense financially.
Larry, what does the industry need to do to make sure that 3D continues to pick up, given that it's made such a huge boost to its income?
Well, all the forces in the industry are allied against standardization, and it reminds me of the balkanization that occurred when we shifted to HD, because, you know, high-definition video was designed to solve the intractable problem of the incompatibility between NTSC video and PAL, North America and the rest of the world. So we wanted to invent a single high-definition standard that could be played everywhere in the world on all possible TV sets, and that's exactly what we got. 400 incompatible high-definition formats because no one manufacturer wanted to run the risk of having their gear, which is compatible with everything else, not sell. And it's easier to do a proprietary system and lock users into your system than to cooperate and come up with a consistent format that plays across all gear. There's the competition in the marketplace for the tech dollar is so severe. I don't see any way in the near future, short of government regulation, that the industry is going to pull itself up by its socks and say, okay, we're going to standardize. This is exactly the way it's going to be, and we're all going to compete based upon the quality of our gear. Industry hates that.
Tim, do you think that 3D is going to make it?
You know, it does depend on that standardization and the glasses issue. You know, if the industry looks back at its success story of DVD, they made some big money because they standardized DVD, and everybody got a taste of that. The studios got a taste of it. The manufacturers got a taste of it. They need to take a look at that and figure out how they can make it happen.
Very good. I think that was a good discussion all the way around, and I think that's going to – Tim, where can people find you?
You can find me at mdialog.com or on my blog, onetimstreet.com.
Larry, where can people find you?
I've given up keeping track of all the websites, so let's do this one today. Let's do larryjordan.biz. That's JORDAN.BIZ.
Are you coming in for Macworld?
I am not. I'm going to have to wait. I'm going to be in Las Vegas doing a series called the Storage Visions Conference, talking about the impact of storage on media, which gets me another thing we need to talk about. I think the speed and power of our computers is secondary now to the speed and capability of our storage, which we should add that to a future show.
We should have like a whole talk about storage, because I talk a lot about it. People say, you know, you should do a show about storage. I'm not sure if I could do a whole show about storage, but...
Oh, yeah. You could do... Between storage and archiving, Alex, people would kneel at your feet to hear about that.
Yeah, because we're crazy about that. So, that'd be very good. Now, are you going to CES?
Not going to CES.
Tim, are you
going? I'll be there.
I'm sending my staff to CES.
Ah, very good, very good. And Tim, you are going to CES?
Yes, I'm there Tuesday through Sunday. If you know, hit me up on Twitter if you want to meet up for a drink.
Definitely, I got a wet bar in the hotel room, so I'm ready to.
Alex, you'll never see the show floor.
Yeah, exactly. Well, you know, I get some good gin, get some dry vermouth, and I'm good to go. So, Lon, are you coming in for CES?
I am not. I am not. But I would love to go to a CES one day because I'm a gadget freak. I probably would be bankrupt by the time I left, but but not just because of Las Vegas, but just because I probably want to own everything that I look at. So I try to avoid that.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Where can people find you, Lon?
They can find me on Twitter at LONSEIDMAN. And just want to remind folks, we're doing a conference for independent content producers, people making video, people that are doing, especially people who are doing hyper-local content, you know, lifestyle, news, that kind of thing, in and around Connecticut. And we're going to do that on January 29th in Hartford. So send me a note. I'll give you more information on what we're putting together. It's actually the start of a network that we're forming to help a lot of these independent producers help each other and share some revenue and all sorts of other good stuff. So we're doing that on January 29th. And hit me up on the Twitter.
Thanks. Thanks, Lon. Thanks, everybody.
Thank you.
Thank you, Alex.
And this mess that you've been listening to is This Week in Media. We are over. And This Week in Media is a Pixelcore.tv production produced by Suzanne Llewellyn with technical producers John Riley and Alutha Jamankar. Content contributor is Jason Perrier.